Don't you like kvetching with your subordinates?
I do. My subordinates, I barely even think of you as subordinate anymore.
Barely.
I still do.
I would barely even throw a binder at you.
To be clear, you're still seeing Sabrina.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. And then there were 11. Depending on who exactly you count, there are now 11 Democrats running for president. The most recent edition was on Sunday. Let's get that music going. Hopefully you're not too tired of that music yet, because Senator from Minnesota Amy Klobuchar is running for president. She's a three-term senator and former county attorney of Minneapolis's Hennepin County. She serves on the Senate Judiciary Committee and became better known to the country after asking pointed questions during the Kavanaugh hearing. So here with me to talk about the case for why she will or won't become the Democratic nominee are Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. Hey, Nate. How's it going?
Good.
Are you still enjoying that music?
No, I was deciding whether to debate your assertion that there are 11 candidates running.
Because there's more.
Of Sheila Tittle?
Okay.
Ooh. She's running.
We're going to move right on to Claire.
James, no middle name, Jr. Athens is running.
Okay, fine. Senior politics writer Claire. Hey, Claire, how's it going?
It's good.
Malone.
Claire Malone.
Claire Malone. Sorry.
Don't you forget it.
And, of course, managing editor Micah Cohen. How are you doing?
That's Cohen.
Cohen. Micah Samuel Zabo Cohen.
Ooh, that's a lot of personal information right there.
Middle name, Samuel. Second middle name, my mom's maiden name, Zabo.
And later in the show, we are also going to talk about the politics of the Democrats' Green New Deal. It's been a buzzword for a few months now, and on Thursday, New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey released a resolution describing what exactly it is. But let's begin with Senator Amy Klobuchar. Nate, you wrote the theory of her case for our website. Let's begin with her policy or ideological background. Where does she fit in the party?
So she is relatively moderate. Although I think her positioning might be within the Democrat Party more center-right than right. Again, this is all pretty left because it's the Democrats. Their campaign sees sort of two tracks, which they call, and this is a very old-school way to describe the field, the wine track and the beer track. And typically the beer track are more moderate candidates from the middle of the country who would heavily emphasize retail politics.
And beer.
They really like beer.
Mm-hmm. I like beer.
And the wine track would be people who are from the coasts, probably have some wine, maybe an edible now because it's legal on the coast, right?
I mean, just pass over Colorado.
I like to go home.
Well, then there's like this
CBD.
Then there's CBD, yeah. Then there's this like craft beer track that I call it, which is like Beto and Hickenlooper, which are the candidates that are kind of, on the one hand, a little bit more moderate, middle of the country, but probably have like more of a kind of, I don't know,
hipster appeal?
Hipster, highbrow appeal. They're saying, look, there are all these candidates on the wine track, all these, you know, Harris and Warren and Bernie and Booker. I don't know where they classify Gillibrand. I think Gillibrand doesn't really figure prominently into people's calculations these days about the primary.
Maybe it's one of those wines from CVS that's like 6% alcohol by volume, not exactly beer, not exactly wine.
Barefoot.
I mean, only people from New York know about that because of our weird liquor.
And she's from New York.
Yeah. But look, she is betting on the fact that there'll be an appetite for someone who's running on electability, that she can do very well in Iowa. She'll probably be the only major candidate from a neighboring state to Iowa, and that does help quite a bit. She is thinking that, like, in the debates, because she's a former prosecutor, she was good in the Kavanaugh hearing, she can be kind of funny and heartfelt at different times. And so, you know, her campaign thinks he has certain strengths. And so, therefore, there's, like, this fairly linear path where she blossoms in the debates and then wins Iowa. I think she does have to be a win, maybe a very, very strong second place, beating expectations. And then it's a little bit less clear, but then I think you kind of say, hey, look, I'm the one who can unite the party. There are still a lot of moderates left in the Democratic Party. However, you know, I'm not that moderate. Don't worry. I'm on board, for example, with the Green New Deal. She has said she's behind. So it's kind of like saying, out of all the moderate slash beer track candidates, and they're not quite the same thing, because there are cases like Sherrod Brown, I think, would be challenging to Klobuchar and vice versa if he runs, which he probably will. You know, she arguably has the least baggage, although she does have these reports of mistreatment of her staff that we'll get to, I'm sure, later on. But it's like, okay, if you're going to not go with the left progressive candidate, then who do you go with? I think she can make a pretty good argument, both on kind of electability grounds and in terms of, with the major stuff, she's with the Democrats. and it's more kind of local stuff where she might deviate some more. And Minnesota is fairly purple. So that's the case. I mean, the way I put it, it's all about the Midwest. Midwestern kind of personality, Midwestern electoral strategy.
As two people from the Midwest, I think that's an interesting...
People from the Midwest, I think, in my view as a Midwesterner, I could be... Work hard. The BS factor is relatively
Drink
low.
Beer.
It's a no BS beer or
what?
Wine.
This is but, like total...
Okay, I actually want to... We have to talk about Amy Klobuchar's recent stories, not at the bottom, but at the top. Because, and here's my reason why. Amy Klobuchar has gotten national attention for exactly two things. One, her roundly applauded performance during the Kavanaugh hearings as a tough but polite questioner, right? Mm-hmm. She got a lot of excellent press for that. Before that, people did not really know who Amy Klobuchar was outside of Minnesota, where we should note she's extremely popular.
Mm-hmm.
The other time that Amy Klobuchar has gotten national attention is in the past few days for these allegations that she was abusive to staff, not just a mean boss, but like straight up abusing her power and stuff like that. I don't know if that will affect things, but I can see those allegations coloring her campaign, and here's why I would say that. And I might be wrong, but this is, I think, a decently strong theory that should be considered, which is if there are going to be close to 20 people in the race, some of whom are known, someone once described it to me as like there are candidates in this race that are known outside of Trump, right? They have their own identities. They're not just this figure sort of filling in as like, well, I could be the opposite of him. Amy Klobuchar, I don't think, has that. And so if she has these two prominent national examples of who Amy Klobuchar is, one of which is very unflattering, I do think it's worth considering whether or not that is going to be a problem for her campaign off the bat. Just because if she's known for two things and one of them is bad, what does that do to your campaign kickoff?
I've gone back and forth a little bit in my own head over whether this is, one, how big of a story this should be to begin with, and two, given that it is a story, how much of a problem it will present for Klobuchar. I guess what I would say is it is problematic for her, if only because, you know, the way Nate put it in his piece was she is playing a long game. Between here and her winning the nomination, a bunch of shit has to go right for her. And so anything that goes wrong is a problem. Now, that may sound like sort of obvious for anyone, but it's actually not true for anyone. Someone like Harris or someone like Biden, I think, has more room for error than someone like Klobuchar, who has to build up national name recognition. As Claire mentioned, she's starting off here with a little bit of trouble. You know, if this story broke about Biden, for example, then voters are adding that bit of information in with decades of other information. Now, that said, I think this story will fade, and I think voters will get a lot of new inputs about Klobuchar. But I don't know. I think it's a minor problem for her.
I don't know. I don't think we can make that determination yet.
So let me just back up a little bit of what you were saying about her name recognition. In the most recent Monmouth poll out at the beginning of February, 39% of Democrats or Democratic leaners hadn't heard of Amy Klobuchar. Now, that is worse than former Congressman from Maryland, John Delaney. It's amongst the lowest of anybody running, right? So people really don't know who she is. And also, in terms of abusive behavior, in case people are not familiar, let me just read briefly from the Huffington Post article. They said, quote, some of former Klobuchar staffers, all of whom spoke to HuffPost on condition of anonymity, describe Klobuchar as habitually demeaning and prone to outbursts of cruelty that make it difficult to work in her office for long. It is common for staff to wake up to multiple emails from Klobuchar characterizing one's work as, quote, the worst briefing or press release she'd seen in her decades of public service, according to two former aides and emails seen by HuffPost. This isn't completely new, right? We've heard of this in the past in campaigns. How do things like this play out, Nate?
Other things being held equal, this is a story that people who are in Washington, D.C. and have a lot of peers that work for campaigns, so that means both people who are Democrats and because there's overlap between political people and journalists, you know, journalists too. So these rumors have gone around for a long time, and I think it's an important fact to know that like this person's like an unpleasant, maybe beyond unpleasant to actually abusive boss, potentially. There is data on this, by the way. She does have very high turnover rates, so, you know, that's a basis for it, apart from anonymous allegations. I just do wonder if it seems all that severe to people who are not in those circles. The allegations, we should say, are anonymous, whereas conversely, there are people on the record defending her. There's not a ton of detail. Maybe some of that detail will come out, and you speak to some people and say there's more that will come out.
There's other detail, by the way. She threw objects at people and papers. I mean, these are some of the allegations that are out there. It's not just verbal or written.
And to follow up on what you said, Nate, about the numbers, we have data from Legistorm that says that up until 2016, Amy Klobuchar had the highest rate of staffing turnover in the Senate. And she's no longer number one, I think, in 2017 and 2018.
Yeah, when I first heard about this, I thought, oh, female politician being accused of being a mean boss, this is like a typical men and women are judged differently for the same behavior. But the details in the story, I think, take it out of that realm. I mean, our boss here, as Nate reminded us earlier, if Nate was like throwing shit at us, I think we'd all have a problem with that.
We have a pretty laissez-faire style here.
That's just
we're pretty easy going.
The campaign has responded saying this is a gendered response, basically, to the way that she treats her staff.
Hit it, Claire.
This is a thing that is one of my least favorite responses to legitimate questions or claims that people make about female candidates. And female politicians are like, whatever, that you should use all the tools in your arsenal. But I think that the press has to be just as vigilant about reporting and talking about these allegations for female politicians as they would to male politicians. And you should be very wary of people responding to legitimate stories as, oh, that's just sexist. Because to me, that blunts when real sexism is happening. And sometimes you just have to deal with the facts of a story. So I sort of dislike the hiding behind sexism on some stuff. Female politicians are going to use it because, again, politicians use everything in their arsenal to do it. Like, whatever, that's how the game is played. But I also think that people should be critical thinkers about this and critical readers about this. I think that there is also, there's a difference in a story. Like, I don't think women have to be professionally warm in the workplace. And I think that that's a thing that a lot of women, when they see a story like this, relate to. It's like, well, why do I have to be like the nurturer in the office and the mentor this person or do that or whatever? Amy Klobuchar doesn't have to be anyone's mentor if she doesn't want to. She is elected to serve the people of Minnesota, and she seems to be a pretty, as people have said, a workhorse legislator, blah, blah, blah. You don't have to be professionally warm. But I do think that why this story is legitimate is being president is a stressful job that involves lots of things coming at you throughout the day. And if she's having this response to being the senator from Minnesota, there's some like legitimate question. This is why I think this is why the story has been pursued is A, it's supposedly led people to not take jobs with her. And B, I think it's, you know, if we classically think of a presidential campaign as a job interview, well, that's something to be to think about for voters.
There's a whole other conversation, I think, about let's say all this is true. She's a really horrible boss that is overly demanding, mean, verging on abusive to her reports. There's a great conversation to have about like how much we should care about that in a president. Because I'm not...
Like LBJ was mean.
Yeah. Trump seems to be pretty mean to his staff. I'm not convinced we should care all that much, frankly.
So in 2015, there were very similar allegations made against Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
And that story, from my recollection, you know, I hadn't remembered that at all from the previous campaign because it just didn't really gain traction. And there are things, it was like an independent Vermont newspaper that came out with it instead of more prominent brands like Huffington Post and Politico and BuzzFeed. But I don't know. To me, it's all about the ratios in which these issues are discussed, where it seems that, like, for women candidates, things are problematized more. And so for a long time, Elizabeth Warren, the DNA test was kind of the first thing that people would talk about with her and not like the fifth thing after her policy positions or her chances to win or whatever else. And I think we'd say the ultimate example of this, of course, was Hillary Clinton and emails.
Let's talk a little bit more about the case for why she could be the Democratic nominee. But before we do that, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by Casper Mattress. Want to upgrade your sleep game? Look no further than Casper, the sleep company with outrageously comfortable products at not so outrageous prices. From mattresses and pillows to sheets and duvets, transform the way you sleep. The mattress is a game changer. Experience Casper for yourself and get the sleep you deserve. The Casper mattress combines four layers of pressure-relieving foams for all-night comfort. It's softer under your shoulders and firmer under your hips for healthy alignment and extra support. Plus, breathable foams are designed to keep you cool all night long. With bedding, bed frames, and even a dog bed, Casper has everything you need to create the perfect sleep environment. You'll even get a risk-free trial on all mattresses. And with Casper's President's Day sale happening now, it's the perfect time to upgrade your mattress. What are you waiting for? Upgrade your sleep game right now by going to Casper.com. You'll get 10% off any purchase with a mattress today. That's Casper.com. Terms and conditions apply. Additional fees may apply for Hawaii and Alaska. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Simply Safe. No one should feel unsafe at home, period. Fear has no place in a place like home. That's been Simply Safe's mission from day one. You may have seen their commercial about it during the big game this year. If you didn't, you can find it online. Simply Safe blankets your whole home with protection, around-the-clock professional monitoring that makes sure police are on the way when you need them. The security sensors are tiny, blending in with your home so you won't notice them. The Verge calls Simply Safe the best home security, and it's a wire-cutter top pick. As more than 3 million Simply Safe customers already know, it feels good to fear less. So protect your home today. You'll get free shipping on any system order. Just visit simplysafe.com/politics. That's simplysafe.com/politics to protect your home and family today. simplysafe.com/politics.
I'm watching a Casper dog bed unboxing video.
I am too.
Oh, not an actual dog?
The dog does not come in the box, no.
Why did
there's a dog in the video though?
Oh, two dogs, two fat dogs. Those dogs need to lose weight.
Okay. But wouldn't you be that fat too if you got to lay on a Casper dog bed all day?
I would.
So, Klobuchar.
Char.
Char?
Char.
Char.
What did I say?
Char.
Like the disgusting vegetable.
So, Nate, you started us off by saying that one of Senator Klobuchar's main arguments is her electability. Do we have data that backs that up?
Sure, and you would start out by looking at her winning margins in Minnesota, where she won, first elected by 20 points in 2006, reelected by 35 points in 2012, 24 points last year. In all cases, she was performing well outside of the Twin Cities. She won, for example, 51 out of 87 counties in Minnesota in 2018, which is fewer than she used to. She used to win almost all. But still, given how rare it is for Democrats to perform well in rural Midwestern counties, that's pretty good. And if you look at her margin relative to the presidential margin in each state, she has one of the four best elections in 2018 among Democratic Senate candidates. The other three being an interesting group, Joe Manchin from West Virginia, Bernie Sanders of Vermont, despite losing Beto O'Rourke from Texas, is also in that group of people who really overperformed the partisanship of their states or districts. So she has this argument. She can also argue that, hey, I'm from the most important region of the country, the upper Midwest, where Democrats, of course, lost Wisconsin and Michigan, actually almost lost Minnesota as well. You can kind of treat Pennsylvania as an honorary Midwestern state. We sometimes do that at 538. And she can also kind of say, hey, look, I'm someone who's going to be more pragmatic, would be her term, I think, and I'm not going to like sell you all this stuff that is a pipe dream. And so I think there are independents who might, in theory, cross over to vote for her. So electability is a credible argument made by Klobuchar.
Yeah, to give you a sense, Morning Consult released approval ratings for every senator in their home state. And Klobuchar is number 6 on that list. But everybody else in the top 10 is, for example, Bernie Sanders is number 1. But, you know, he's in Vermont, an overwhelmingly blue state. Number 2, Patrick Leahy. Number 3, John Barrasso, a Republican in an overwhelmingly Republican state. Number 4, John Thune, a Republican in an overwhelmingly Republican South Dakota. Brian Schatz, Democrat in overwhelmingly Democratic Hawaii. And then Klobuchar in Minnesota, a pretty purple state. So it's really like, yeah, she has demonstrated a large amount of cross-party appeal, which is just, you can't really argue with that. It's there in the elections. Now, I do wonder a little bit if her message, hey, I have cross-party appeal, if that's just unrealistic in the context of a presidential race.
That was my question with Kirsten Gillibrand, too, which is like these people who say, like, listen, I've won in rural areas of my state or like have cross-party appeal in different parts of my state. Given how aware we are nationally of like drawing strong lines, I kind of wonder if that translates nationally, like because people do have this sense of familiarity and comfort with their home state politicians. And they, I do think you kind of like make allowances, right? Where you say like, well, they're if you're a Republican, you might say like, well, they're a Democrat, but they're like, they're a Minnesota Democrat, you know, like it's my kind of Democrat. But if you go to Texas or I don't know,
yeah,
you know, another state, they might be like, it's a Democrat.
But maybe you can't do that nationally, basically.
Yeah, I guess I think it's like that's one of those questions that I'm really curious to see play out over the next few months is like these people, women specifically, I think, because I wonder if there's also like this woman factor too, is if those women nationally will have a different perception that they do in their home states.
I just have a hard time seeing any Democrat, and frankly, particularly a woman, winning over that many Republican voters. I think they'll be, by the time we reach November, you know, they'll be demonized. There'll be tons of oppo. It's just hard to imagine. Now, maybe they win over independents, but I don't know. Nate, in the context of a presidential election, is an electability-focused campaign, or let me rephrase that, is a I have cross-party appeal, is that really a realistic strategy?
I think it's actually a more potent strategy than people in the media would assume. Because if you ask Democrats, Monmouth University asked Democrats a question that said, basically, would you sacrifice some of your policy views for a candidate who was more likely to beat Trump? And like 55% of Democrats said yes, they would. 37% said no, they wouldn't. You know, questions like that have been asked in the past, and electability has never done so well. So, like, I think a very practical discussion about the Midwest and her strengths as a relatively moderate politician. I mean, I don't expect her to go out and kind of talk about it explicitly. It's more about, like, drawing contrast. And then when you kind of get deep into the primary, then you probably begin to have some of those arguments, and those become, like, polling fuel. I mean, we'll have to see. If we are in April of next year and she and Kamala Harris are the two women left standing, and Klobuchar is polling 4 points ahead of Trump, and Harris is polling 3 points behind Trump, right? That'll be a fairly salient series of discussions.
The Midwest argument is potentially more interesting to me because the Midwest is clearly, it punches above its weight in terms of the Electoral College and is important electorally in presidential elections. I'm just not sure that winning over Republican voters is...
How much, Nate, do you know how much of a boost there is from being a regional politician? Do you win your own state or the neighboring states by a significant margin?
In Minnesota, we should note, borders
Iowa. In your state, there's typically a 6 or 7 point boost. It depends on various things. It's been getting smaller, arguably over time, as partisanship increases. But look, I mean, it's, you know, it shouldn't be lost on people that Obama was Midwestern and performed really well in those Midwestern states in both of his general elections. And like, that's really important. The Midwest punches above its weight in terms of the Electoral College. So Obama, a candidate who overperformed the Midwest, actually did more strongly in the Electoral College than you would have thought based on his popular vote margins. And Hillary Clinton, obviously the opposite was true, you know.
Although she's from Illinois originally.
It is funny, like, kind of what's it mean to, and Obama's from Hawaii.
Yeah.
Originally.
What does it mean to be Midwestern?
It's a state of mind, Claire.
It is. Micah is rolling his eyes.
Micah's the only person at this table who hasn't spent a chunk of their life in the Midwest.
I find Midwesterners.
But you're from Pennsylvania, which is a Midwestern.
Finish that sentence, Micah.
Just overly self-conscious is the way I would put it.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's just like being Midwestern is a big chunk of their identity in my limited experience.
Just like being from Philly, a big part of your identity is being like E-A-G-L-E-S.
Isn't a sweatsuit called the Philadelphia tuxedo? Like, don't you even have identity
that's very insulting
to clothing?
Can I say why Midwesterners have that identity, especially the ones that you might know on the East Coast? Is because, I mean, if my experience was anything, I came to college on the East Coast, and people just laid in to where I was from. They treated it like a f***ing joke. And
it is the butt of a lot of
jokes. It is so personally offensive. It's like, screw off.
You mean like I've done on this podcast today?
Yeah.
All right. Before we wrap up with Klobuchar, let's talk about the five corners that we've discussed with many of the other candidates. It's the five constituencies, Nate, that you've described of the Democratic Party. It's millennials, it's party loyalists, it's Hispanic and Asian voters, black voters, and the left. So where does Klobuchar do well, and where does she come up lacking with regard to those five corners?
I mean, by that metric, she doesn't do that well at all, because she's clearly not going to be the top choice of the left, whether or not she's acceptable to the left in a field that gets winnowed down, maybe. So if you're running on the beer track, then you're not going for the left wing of the Democratic Party, unless you're Sherrod Brown, who actually is an interesting candidate. Minnesota is about 20% non-white, as compared to 40% for the country as a whole. So she has not historically had to make that many inroads.
And the electorate is even more white, right?
And the electorate is, because you actually have like a lot of immigration from different places into Africa, so Somalia and Southeast Asia and places like that. So it's more diverse than you'd think, but like because these are relatively new immigrants, a lot of time they aren't necessarily yet registered to vote if they're citizens at all. And so therefore, you know, you are usually appealing to white voters to win races in Minnesota, and her campaign, which would heavily lead on Iowa. Well, Iowa is also even whiter than Minnesota. And so, yeah, at some point, like, you're limiting the size of your market initially in a field where there are going to be lots of people of color, where you're going to be drawing contrast between the Midwest and the coast, and the coasts are more diverse. And so that is an issue for her, is that she is running in a primary where 40% of the electorate roughly is non-white. And again, not that she couldn't ever win appeal to non-white voters. I mean, John Kerry was quite popular among black voters in 2004.
Although, of course, he wasn't necessarily running against a field of other prominent candidates of color.
So Beto O'Rourke did defeat in a very Hispanic district a Hispanic Democratic incumbent. So it can work, but I don't think she's going to be like really even making that much of an effort with a strategy that will probably focus a lot on retail, meaning Iowa and New Hampshire. And I think she hopes that if she does well in those states, she gets enough of a boost where then minority voters will come along.
But she clearly needs a boost. I mean, to be clear here, we're talking about a candidate who is starting off a Democratic primary, and we're all saying she is not going to do well with the left, and it doesn't seem like she has much appeal to start with non-white voters.
That's a big part of the
party. That's a big part of the party, right? So, like, again, going back to the start of this conversation, a lot of things have to go right, I think, for Klobuchar to win. She could win, but when you phrase it that way, you know, the left and non-white voters are a big, big chunk of the Democratic Party.
I mean, that five corners metric also does not speak much about gender, which, of course, is another potential big split within the party. And the fact that roughly three-fifths of voters are women is a good thing if you're a woman candidate. Other things being equal, and of course, maybe things aren't equal in how candidates are treated by the press. But it is interesting that, like, all the other beer track candidates are guys. So Biden, Brown, Beto, again, on the craft beer track, Hickenlooper.
Bob.
Tim Ryan, if he runs, right? Michael Bennett, if he runs. We're getting pretty obscure here. Mitch Landrieu, if he runs. So there are a lot of, like, working class white women, and that's an interesting constituency for Klobuchar, too. And maybe also, if it gets down to it, then the fact that she is a woman and would be the first woman president might mollify within the party some concerns you'd have about, like, oh my gosh, you know, we dominated an old white dude versus a white woman, I think is a little bit different.
All right, well, let's leave the conversation about Klobuchar there and turn to the politics of the Green New Deal. But before we do that, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by SelectQuote. If you're thinking about life insurance, did you know that the older you get, the more it costs? That's why locking in your rate for up to 10 or 20 years now makes sense. The rate you lock in won't change, even if your health status does. If you think you can't afford it, chances are SelectQuote can help you get it for less than a dollar a day. SelectQuote comparison shops up to 10 highly rated companies, including Prudential, Banner Life, and Mutual of Omaha, and others, to find you the company with the best rates. For example, SelectQuote could find a 35-year-old man a $500,000 policy for under $19 a month, or a 37-year-old woman a $750,000 policy for under $22 a month. We know at 538 listeners like to aggregate data in order to get the best picture. Get your free quote at selectquote.com/538 today. That's selectquote.com/538 for your free quote. Get full details on the example policy at selectquote.com/commercials. Your premium could vary depending on your health, issuing company, and other factors. It's not available in all states. Don't put off protecting your family another day. selectquote.com/538. All right. The left wing of the Democratic Party has been talking about a Green New Deal in Washington since the Democrats won the House. And on Thursday, we got some sense of what that deal is. It essentially aims to remake the American economy by cutting carbon emissions by 40-60% in the next 10 years and then fully within the next 30, and eliminating economic insecurity for all Americans in the process. So that's a big statement. What exactly is in the 14-page Green New Deal resolution, Claire?
Well, I would call it an outline. It basically sets broad 30,000 foot up goals for what this big program would accomplish. So massively reducing carbon emissions. There is a jobs guarantee provision in there. It is not a policy specific document at all. It is a broad outline of we're going to lose 90% of coral reefs. This is the year that temperatures will be, you know, an unacceptable level, blah, blah, blah. It goes through, it sort of uses that big high profile climate report that came out and said, listen, we need to start making big benchmark changes. This is the broad vision that we have, but it is not a specific policy document.
Are there any policies in it?
What do we mean when we say it doesn't have
this is how we do any of this.
Right.
Oh, it has goals, right?
Yeah, it's a goal document.
It's a goal document. It's we want to get off fossil fuels. We want to make a ton of investments in remaking our infrastructure. We want to improve the social safety net.
Oh, by the way, we want jobs and health care for everyone.
Yeah, those are Democratic goals.
Okay.
I don't get the snark about this.
Michael, let me read just one bullet point in the Green New Deal resolution. It says, quote, providing all people of the United States with high-quality health care, affordable, safe, and adequate housing, economic security, and access to clean water, clean air, healthy and affordable food, and nature. So putting forth a resolution that says we want to solve the issues that humanity has been facing for basically all of its existence, I mean, what is the purpose either politically, structurally, in terms of policy, of putting this forward?
I think the purpose here and the innovation here is in getting to a place rhetorically that in the views of the authors of this Green New Deal matches the scale of the problem. In other words, critics, when they read this, a lot of critics said, this is pie in the sky. This is
a socialist fever dream, I think was one of the quotes.
Yeah, like ambitious to the point of ludicrous. And the response is like, yeah, no shit. Look at the scale of the problem.
Yeah, I agree with you. I would also say that one of the reasons why it's purposely vague is Democrats are running for president. And pretty much all of them have said,
right,
I embrace the idea of a Green New Deal. I embrace the framework of a Green New Deal. And I think, quite frankly, a lot of them will fill in policy proposals as fits what they think, to go back to the electability argument, what works
for
in
them.
This 2020 climate. And I do think that that's a big part of it. I'll also say, like, going back to some of the reporting I did for my piece on the left, like this sort of progressive left, I think they're still legitimately working out policy details. Like, I think some of this stuff is so new that, like, they have to listen, people, like, it's like there's a policy apparatus that then filters into Congress and people are hiring up in presidential campaigns. I think some of it has to do with
just there's work to be done.
Yes.
There's also, this has changed from an earlier version. The latest one, the one from AOC and Markey, sort of makes more of an attempt to keep labor in the fold. And you see a lot of language in the doc that's like, you know, fair wages, union protections. So they are making some sort of political calculations. It's not totally like a fever dream. You know, is it like a perfect political document? No. The call for universal health care sort of comes out of nowhere and is a little weird.
It kind of reminds me of, I was in Model United Nations, and you would have to write these, like, some of the point of Model UN was to teach 14-year-olds how to write, like, UN lawyers, which is sort of a weird thing to do with your free time. But, like, that's sort of what it reminded me about, and it was just like these broad sweeping statements,
right?
And it's kind of like just getting it out on the public.
I mean, it sounds like you're describing it as kind of childish. Like, is this a normal
political? I think that's skewing my words a bit.
Oh.
I think it's I'm not a historical scholar of the New Deal. I'm curious about how they presented it initially. You know, was there something, or in other big social programs, how have these, like, broad frameworks been rolled out?
Yeah, I feel like, Micah, you are downplaying too much the fact that there is a greater or lesser degree depending on which version of this you look at, because there was some version with FAQs that, like, was on AOC's website, and then it wasn't, and they kind of said, This isn't the real version, but it was on their website. But some of the versions quite explicitly fuse together environmental policy and climate policy with very, very, very ambitious left-wing democratic goals. And that seems like a change from before, where the idea might have been, okay, well, climate is hard enough. These other things are hard enough. Let's try to focus on the environment. So, you know, so one critique you can make is that this muddles environmentalism with about a bunch of other stuff. And, you know, so it used to be that people on the right would say, oh, Democrats are interested in curbs on emissions because their real motivation is to cripple the industrial economy and redistribute wealth, right? And Democrats would say, no, this is actually like a, whatever the term is, Pigovian optimal tax, where there are externalities from pollution. You have to price that properly. And by the way, this will create jobs as we become a leader in the U.S., right? This is a shift away from that to saying, oh, no, it is all tied together, and that climate change / global warming is a symptom of, like, the capitalist economy, and we really want to move far to the left on a bunch of issues as part of a new deal. So that's a big shift and a big risk.
And that's a fair criticism, I think. The muddling of it with other Democratic priorities, I think, is a fair criticism. What I was trying to get at, and maybe I wasn't clear enough, is I don't think this is pie in the sky is a fair criticism. I don't think there's anything wrong with ambition, particularly as it relates to climate change.
It seems like post-2016, a lot of Democrats felt like their party wasn't aiming high enough, right? Donald Trump offered a whole bunch of things that seemed implausible or maybe even impossible and got elected. Hillary Clinton kept talking about, you know, what's practical. And so now all of these 2020 candidates are jumping on board with the Green New Deal. Is there any risk of overcorrecting and damaging Democrats' electoral chances?
Sure.
I think that the lesson that Democrats took from 2016 is that inspiration in politics and the big idea seems to actually be what captures voters' imagination. And that's what this is. I read this as everyone in the Democratic Party is on board with, like, we should save the environment, right? Here's a broad thing that we all now refer to but could have lots of different versions of, and it doesn't matter because most voters will just be like, yeah, I want to save the planet too.
Green New Deal, which is a, we'll just hear Green New Deal, which I think is a really smart label from
yes.
Democrats' point of view to put on this. So that's why I think there's a lot of upside for Democrats here in that people do respond to ambition and big ideas. There is also risks, to be clear, to Nate's point. There is language in here, I think, that could be used against Democrats. And if you look at the polling on environmental policies and government interventions, stuff like making investments in renewable energies, stuff like upgrading America's infrastructure, like smart electrical grids, all that polls amazingly well, even with Republicans. It's when you get to, like, carbon taxes and anything that affects the fossil fuel industry that things start to pour, not exactly poorly, but more poorly than the like infrastructure investment stuff. So I do think there is some risk here, but, like, I think Green New Deal is a smart framing of these issues. And, like, look, it's not like there was a alternative strategy on climate change that was about to win over skeptics and make a lot of progress on the issue, right? That wasn't the case. So I don't think there's all that much risk. If you're a climate change activist and you really want to see action here, you know, I don't think there's all that much risk to you because there wasn't much chance of action before.
But in general, how much do voters care about the environment? It doesn't seem like in the past people have voted in presidential elections based on climate change and the environment. Somebody can correct me if they want to, but where does this rank now?
I think obviously the bet is that it ranks higher. I mean, it certainly is true that, like, in 2008, all the Democrats ran on a pretty cautious platform, despite it being this time when Republicans were in a lot of disarray, and because Bush was very unpopular and you had financial crisis and, like, some unpopular wars. The policies that Obama and Clinton and Edwards pushed were not that radical, and this is kind of a reaction to that. And radical is a loaded term. I mean, a lot of this stuff is fairly popular and polls pretty well. You know, I do think that, like, if the message is that the environment is uniquely urgent, then to bundle a bunch of stuff together with it might undermine that message a little bit. But, you know, there's also this whole theory of the Overton window, where if you ask for a lot, you ask for the stars, you get the moon. Am I saying that right?
Shoot for the stars, you might shoot for the moon, you might just land among the stars.
Even if you miss, you'll land among the stars.
Which doesn't make sense to me because the stars are further out from the moon.
It just means you didn't land on the moon. You just kept going on out into the universe.
I'm now getting a glimpse of how terrible it would be to be in a poetry class with Nate Silver.
Okay.
That metaphor doesn't make sense.
But the idea is that if you shift the conversation to, oh my gosh, they want to socialize the whole economy and retrofit every building in America and give a universal basic income and, you know, and carbon tax, whatever else, right? And it's like, oh, what if we just have like a cap and trade system instead? Then it seems more reasonable. You know, that theory has become in vogue a little bit, and I think there are definitely cases where intuitively it seems right to me that you're in any type of negotiation, you try and change the anchor of where that negotiation is headed. But at the same time, I think there's a little bit of overconfidence from Democrats where they have proposed all these new policies on the environment, on healthcare, and other things, and they initially poll pretty well as abstract concepts. You know, less clear how well they will do when they become A, more specific, and B, begin to be attacked by Republicans as well as some Democrats. So we've seen, for example, on the AOC 70% marginal tax rate, you know, we've started to see a couple of polls where that did not poll particularly well. There were earlier polls where it had. It's very sensitive to question wording about where you set the thresholds and how you describe it and whatever else. But like, but there's a lot of new stuff Democrats are putting out there that is bold slash aggressive slash far left, what do you want to call it, right? It's bold. I think it's safe to say that. These are not timid proposals, this and Medicare for All, which is also something which can mean a lot of different things to different people, by the way. They're not timid proposals, but they're also pretty new, and so kind of how this will manifest itself in the debate in 6 months or a year, you know, sometimes there are things where voters might prefer the policies that Democrats offer, but it nonetheless symbolizes a shift to the left and turns off independents in the suburb. I mean, I don't know. You know, I think it's like...
I think it's
I think it's like simultaneously true that, number one, the media tends to underrate how popular some left-wing ideas are.
But Democrats overrate.
But also that, like, not so much they overrate, but they also underrate how important and simple it is that if you appeal to voters in the center and independents, that 9 times out of 10, or actually politics is more complicated than that, right? So probably not 9 times out of 10, 7 times out of 10, that's probably the better strategy. And I do think partisans on both sides, literal both sides quote here, folks, I do think partisans on both sides are usually full of it when they say we can enact all these policies we really want and it will help us electorally too. I think it's usually more honest to say we can enact these policies we want, and these policies are extremely important, so we're willing to take risks because otherwise there's no way to stop climate change, or at least America's role in climate change.
Look, polling right now shows pro-environment opinion on the upswing. So like Gallup found 62% of people said the government is doing too little to protect the environment. That's the highest it's been in 12 years. 57% of Americans would prioritize the environment even if it means hurting economic growth versus just 35% who said the opposite, right? That's pretty amazing considering they're putting hurt economic growth in the question. You know, how much of that is, what's the term for it, Nate? It's just a reaction to the president?
Thermostatic, where, yeah, anything the president supports tends to actually become less popular.
Right. So how much of that is just a different way of saying, I oppose Trump? You know, I'm not sure. I guess what I would say is, look, the New Deal happened after the like entire economy collapsed and like all hell broke loose economically, right? So if that's the analogy here, then I'm not sure that politics is set up well to do something this ambitious, right? You need something equally epic as rocket fuel to, you get what I mean?
Yeah, but we never had a post-2008 crash. There was never like a full-scale program. And so I think this is kind of
viewed as.
Yeah. I think this is the response 10 years later. That's how probably people would maybe start to frame it a bit. Because instead of doing a massive jobs or economic stimulus plan, Obama chose to do healthcare. Well, and that was a choice that they made consciously. Of, you know, we have this much political capital. What do we want to do? And there kind of was this choice to do healthcare.
They also did a stimulus plan first. It wasn't massive.
Yeah. There. Yes. So I think that's what people would say of like, this is something that we've needed It's just now we have this plan and it has this different element of environmentalism.
But you're kind of saying, Micah, that in order for the political ambition, the political will to be there, people have to feel like they are in crisis. People have to feel like things have been burned down and therefore need to be rebuilt or something.
I think so. But Claire's response is a totally fair one, which is that in 100 years, when historians are looking at it, at this, like we're looking back at, you know, the Great Depression and the New Deal, they will see this as a response to the Great Recession. You know, I'm not sure people do feel climate change right now, akin to how people felt the economy before those New Deal reforms started to be put into place. Like, they had gone through Hoover, you know, he was like, oh, just give more money to charity and they can, you know, help people. And there were like bread lines and protests and all that stuff. If you look at polls of like, how would you rate the overall quality of the environment in this country today as excellent, good, only fair, or poor? 40% say excellent or good. So like right there is a big chunk of people who I don't think are going to be predisposed to favor big, big action, right? There's a huge partisan split, obviously. But like politics has like a hard enough time getting its act together to keep the government open, you know?
Yeah, how the government may not be open by the end of the week.
How the f*** are they going to do like a huge, huge thing? I just think, you know, think big.
All right. Well, I think we are going to leave it at that for today. Nate, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Did I convince you, Nate?
Nah, really, man. I'd give you a C+.
Claire, thank you.
Thanks, Galen.
Thank you, Micah.
Did I convince you, Claire? Listeners, write in if I convinced you. At Micah Cohen on Twitter.
Convince people of
what?
Yeah,
of what?
That this is a smart document politically.
Oh, that's what you were trying to convince people? All right, we're going to leave it there. But before we do, let me tell you guys that we are hiring a podcast intern.
Ooh.
We're also hiring a bunch of other interns at 538. So you should check out those postings. We'll also tweet something from the 538 Politics handle. But the time is now. We're going to stop accepting applications soon. So if you're interested in working on this podcast, helping us make other ambitious things throughout the year, go apply. I think it's students and people who are recently graduated qualify to apply to work with us. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store. Thank you for listening, and we will see you soon.